They like snorted something that they thought was cocaine. It was actually pure LSD, and it was 100 to 700 times the normal dose.
Oh,
so they ingested like 1,000 to 7,000 micrograms of it.
Hi, I'm Akshi.
And I'm Shayna, and you're listening to Unpacking the Eerie,
a podcast that explores the intersections of our dark and morbid curiosities through a social justice lens.
You're welcome. Before we get started, here's our usual content warning. This episode will include discussions that include torture, homophobia, and racism.
All right.
Hello.
Hello.
I guess before we get started, we wanted to just like acknowledge a few things. Today is May 29th. This might be coming out later. But, you know, the past couple weeks, there's just been a barrage of shootings. And, you know, I think I'm not alone when I say, like, I really can't stop thinking about all of these, like, families and survivors that will be impacted for the rest of their lives. In Buffalo, New York, in Irvine at the Taiwanese Presbyterian Church, and most recently, Uvalde, Texas. I'm just thinking about how these people and these children just died, like, terrified doing everyday things that they should be able to feel safe doing, you know, going to the grocery store, going to connect with community, just trying to go to school. In communities that already face violence of racism and classism, xenophobia, and like other forms of violence from the state. And I'm just sending a lot of love and healing and solidarity to those of you who see family members and friends and people you love in the faces of the victims and the survivors of these shootings. My heart's really with you. It hurts and as in rage with you.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking about this the other day that, like, I'm a pretty empathetic person, which makes sense. So I'm a social worker, you know. But I've just realized over the past couple of years that I don't have the same emotional responses when things like this happen that I used to. And like, that's kind of like scary for me because clearly me and I'm not alone in this, have developed like a defense of not being able to like feel the grief of like such shocking and violent acts such as the ones that you just mentioned. It's just so jarring to me to see this happen at the same time that like they're trying to ban abortions across the country, and it just like it's like not clicking at all. I don't know. It's really scary. It's really scary on a lot of levels. And I think a lot of people would be like, people are always like, this is not America. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, yes, it is. You know, I saw this thing on Instagram, which I wanted to read. It's from Sarah Lee, whose Instagram handle is Sarah Lee. The myth of American exceptionalism is one paid for in blood. Never mind what makes America exceptional is also what makes it crude. The casual violence, the apathy from leadership. America spends billions of dollars on propaganda and warfare to feel great, only to turn a blind eye on the very real suffering of the people whose backs built the American dream. What we need now more than ever is a radical reimagining of society. Gun violence, abortion rights, climate change are all interconnected. To be better, we must first abolish the myth that America was ever great to start with. Mm. I guess some of what we're going to be starting to talk about today is relevant to that, because it's one of many very dark stories that are part of American history. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to learn as an adult is that much of what I learned about America, especially not growing up here, it was like entirely false, lies, propaganda. And this is gonna uncover a lot of stuff for people. And it's gonna be the first in a few part series.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything more to share before we shift?
I was just thinking that maybe we can collect some resources, like collect the GoFundMes and the free mental health resources that are being offered right now in the communities that were
impacted.
Yeah. So
yeah.
we can collect those for you and put them in the description.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if this is like coming out 3 weeks later, it's a great time to donate because people have historical amnesia and decide they just want to keep going with their lives. So,
yeah. Or are forced to.
That's true. Yeah, because capitalism doesn't take time for pause or grief or transformation or any of that. Or healing, so.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's all. We shift.
We're gonna shift.
Into the topic of today.
Yes.
It's dark as fuck, but not in the way that you're used to with this podcast. So.
Yeah, different dark.
Different dark. During the early period of the Cold War, the CIA became convinced that communists had discovered a drug or technique that would allow them to control human minds. And in response to this, the CIA began its own program called MKUltra. And they wanted to find a mind control drug that could be weaponized against enemies.
The American government really could not fathom that people could put their communities before their own personal interests. They're like, it must be control.
Yes. I'll go deeper into the Cold War in this, but also I was reading an article about how some prisoners of war ended up wanting to stay in Korea after they were prisoners of war, and America was like, they were brainwashed, they were saying all the same shit over and over and over, and that could be true, you know? Could it also be true that people go elsewhere and realize, oh, fuck, America's really out here being the worst and not want to come home? Anyway, like, with this particular person, I don't know. I think he was tortured, but I feel like there were probably times where people went to war and realized how fucked it was and didn't want to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I'm sure they used this like one instance of brainwash and was like, oh, look at all of our soldiers being brainwashed into thinking that America's not great.
Yeah.
Okay. It just kind of reminds me of, you know, when white people are like, aliens invented the pyramids. How did they get there?
Yeah.
It was so long ago. And I'm just like, you're so racist that you can't even fathom that non-white people could create such intricate systems that you don't understand.
Yeah, I mean,
that it had to be aliens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Indus Valley civilization was also a thing so long ago. They had plumbing.
Yeah. Irrigation systems.
Irrigation systems.
Bye.
So,
MK Ultra, they're wanting mind control. They think their enemies are controlling the minds of their soldiers, and they want to be the ones first to, you know, basically control the whole fucking world, which we'll get to later.
Mm-hmm.
Before we, like, go into MK Ultra, we have to go back a little bit in history. Because it sets the groundwork, the foundation for what's to come. And we're going over to Montreal, Quebec, Canada, at the Allen Memorial Institute, which used to be a mansion. And then I guess the family that owned it, like sold it or gave it to Royal Victoria Hospital in 1940. And then it was renamed Allen Memorial Institute in 1943. So this is a psychiatric hospital and research institute. It was like heralded as like a very like prestigious, high class, top of the line psychiatric hospital. Like, people thought that this was groundbreaking, and that's how they like put it out there. And when they introduced it too, they called it an involuntary psychiatric hospital, that people had freedom to just like go and check in and check out as they pleased. And a lot of the people who came in there were like, I don't know, they were suffering from like a variety of things that were, that could have been, they were pretty mild. I don't know. I don't know how else to describe it. Like,
sure.
You know, like depression. Okay. Like I'm feeling a little sad. Okay. And they didn't have a name for like postpartum, which is what I think a lot of women who went in there were experiencing.
Yeah.
And also there was this one guy who had like a nerve that was freaking out on one side of his face, and he just wanted to get this nerve taken care of because he realized that it was a psychosomatic issue.
Oh, gotcha.
And I guess the only treatments that they were offering at the time is cutting the nerve. And then, you know, half your face is like paralyzed. Ouch. Yeah. So he was like, I don't want to do that. And so he went to this like this psych hospital thinking that they had a better solution.
Sure, sure.
So let me tell you about this fucking psych hospital. It's horrible. The guy who's kind of in charge of all of the things, Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron, a Scottish-born American psychiatrist. And he was like, he had an impressive background. People thought he was like hot shit, you know? He was the head of the Canadian and American Psychiatric Associations, and even like he had leadership positions at the World Psychiatric Association at some point. So this man had a ton of power, and people really trusted what he had to say.
Yeah.
And then he was the first director of the Allen Institute. Some of the things that would go on here when people entered is extreme electric shock. They induced comas into people for weeks, sometimes months.
Jeez.
Yeah, they would make people pee in their bed instead of going to the bathroom because they wanted to promote incontinence. And they wanted to do this because they wanted to like bring that person back to a place of childhood, completely break down all of their, they wanted to wipe their memory. They did all these experiments to see if they could break someone down. This happened to over 100 patients, people who went in being like, oh, I want some help, like a little depressy.
They're like induced comas.
Yeah. And they also injected them with LSD and to brainwash them and led them through like really horrific scenarios. Like people reported just crying for hours and hours and hours and hours on end. There's this one lady who was like, I thought my bones were melting away. They did this without their consent, and no one really had a, like an idea of what psychedelics were at the time. So they were really fucking confused and scared. And reverting back to childhood, literally. One person said after 3 weeks, she said, I didn't know my children. I didn't know my husband or my sister. I had to be toilet trained.
Oh my God.
Yes. And then they also would play these tapes all day long.
You know, it's just like interesting because that was something that I was reading about because I came across this person too. They call it like psychic driving, where they repeat a statement on loop for like hours, hundreds and thousands of times. And now as you were talking about it, I was like, oh my God, that's what Jim Jones did.
Jim Jones did do that.
Yeah. Like playing the shit on the loudspeaker 24/7, so we could see where he gets some of his ideas from.
Oh my God, the legacy of colonial violence is so vast.
Because this is in the 40s, 50s,
40s, 50s, continuing through the 60s.
And then Jim Jones is like in the 60s, 70s. So. Yeah.
You know, the timelines are going to overlap at some point because we're going to go into some people who were subject to these things. So I'm going to tell you a story about one person who went through this like brainwashing experiment. This is an article from The Guardian, and it's written by Ashifa Kassam in Toronto. Sarah Ann Johnson had always known the broad strokes of her maternal grandmother's story. In 1956, Velma Orlikow checked herself into a renowned, quote-unquote, Canadian psychiatric hospital, the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, hoping for help with what we now know as postpartum depression. All the people who I listened to interviews, they were like, we didn't have a name for it. We had we had no idea. I was just in deep sadness after I had my baby. She was in and out of the clinic for 3 years, but instead of improving, her condition completely deteriorated, and her personality underwent jarring changes. More than two decades passed before Johnson and her family had an explanation, and it was much stranger than any of them could imagine. In 1977, it emerged that the CIA had been funding experiments in mind control, brainwashing at the Institute as part of the North America-wide project known as MKUltra. So this is where it connects, mm-hmm. because in the middle of all of this shit that he did, the CIA approached Cameron through the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology, a research foundation, and one of the front organizations they funneled money through, and they encouraged him to apply for a grant, which he did, and then he quickly received, like, a ton of money. From January 1957 to September 1960, the CIA gave Cameron $60,000, which is equivalent now to a little more than $500,000 today.
He did not know that it was being funded by the CIA, which doesn't matter much because they targeted him because they knew that he liked to do experiments like this.
Yes.
And so they were like, oh, this dude would be a good person to do these studies for us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were trying to like front a lot and not make it seem like the CIA was doing these experiments. So yes. Some people who were part of the studies knew that it was through the CIA, and some people like this dude didn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it better, but like...
Yeah. He was like, this is from the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology.
Yeah.
Okay. anyways.
One funny thing that I actually heard at a podcast was the way that they found out about him particularly is because this like investigative journalist who was like going through all of these CIA documents after like using the Freedom of Information Act... they had redacted a ton of stuff on it, but they were, like, bad at redacting, and they figured out this doctor's name because they were bad at redacting it.
Nice. Classic. Back to the story. So, Orly Cal was one of several hundred patients who became unwitting subjects of these experiments in Montreal in the late 1950s and early 60s. "It's almost impossible to believe," said her granddaughter, Sarah Ann Johnson. After her grandmother died, the Canadian artist began reading on the Institute, delving into Orly Cal's journals and court documents. "Some of the things he did to his patients are so horrible and unbelievable that it sounds like the stuff of nightmares. Patients were subjected to high-voltage electroshock therapy several times a day, forced into drug-induced sleeps that could last months, and injected with mega doses of LSD." Mega doses. Mm-hmm. "After reducing them to a childlike state, at times stripping them of basic skills such as how to dress themselves or tie their shoes, Cameron would attempt to reprogram them by bombarding them with recorded messages for up to 16 hours at a time. First came negative messages about their inadequacies, followed by positive ones, in some cases repeated up to 500,000 times."
My goodness. Mm-hmm.
"He couldn't get his patients to listen to them enough, so he put speakers in football helmets and locked them on their heads."
This is literally Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
This must be the inspiration for that movie.
"They were going crazy, banging their..." This is her granddaughter talking. "They were going crazy, banging their heads into walls, so he figured he would put them in a drug-induced coma and play the tapes as long as he needed."
Oh my God.
Yes. This man was head of the Psychiatric Association of multiple countries and the entire world. The history of psychiatry is so fucked up.
Yeah.
It is gnarly.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I remember so my bachelor's in psychology.
Me too.
I mean, I think all my friends got their bachelor's I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them.
A lot.
And I remember I took a class on the, like, controversial issues in psychology. It was like one of the core classes, and we talked about the history of psychiatry and how fucked up it was and what they did to people.
Yeah,
like they really lobotomies.
Yeah,
bro, in the what in the world looks like an ice pick and they're hammering it into their heads.
Yeah, it's really fucked up.
Like, what? And then bloodletting? I remember reading specifically, like, they opened up some early psychiatric hospitals, and they were like, oh, well, if you just kind of drain their blood, they get, like, calm. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. They're about to pass out.
Because you're supposed to have blood in your body, bro.
My God.
I was like, what in the actual world? Who is giving these men license to do these things? And like, you know.
Probably no one, and they're just doing it.
That's true.
Yeah, they're giving themselves license.
They are. And then you also have Linda's out there doing wild ass shit.
Yeah.
Calling it science. Yeah. I can't. I cannot. Anyways. Okay. Along with intensive bouts of electroshock therapy, Johnson's grandmother was given injections of LSD on 14 occasions. She said it made her feel like her bones were melting. She would say, I don't want these. And doctors and nurses would say to her, you're a bad wife, you're a bad mother. If you wanted to get better, you would do this for your family. Think about your daughter. Orlikow died when Johnson was 13 years old. Her experience and the profound imprint it left on her family has influenced Johnson's artwork. So she's an artist. I knew even at a very young age that my grandma was not like other grandmothers. She had a hair trigger for nerves and anger. If someone bumped into her or if we were in a restaurant, someone spilled something on her, she would just explode. She wouldn't hurt anybody. She would just scream and yell, and it would take hours to calm her down. Johnson was close to her grandmother, often spending afternoons at her home while her parents worked. They would sit on the couch and watch TV together, surrounded by piles of books and newspapers. Years later, Johnson found out that the experiments had wreaked havoc on Orlikow's brain. It could take her 3 weeks to read a newspaper, months to write a letter, and years to read a book.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. But she kept trying. She kept trying to be her old self and do the things that she used to love, said Johnson. Now I think that she was just sitting in a big pile of her own failures every day on that couch. Similar scenes played out across Canada as former patients of the Institute attempted to return to their lives. It tainted her whole family, said Alison Steele, whose mother was admitted to the Institute in 1957. Her mother was 33 at the time, reeling from the loss of her first child and showing signs of depression. Back at this time, Dr. Cameron, he was this miracle psychologist, said Steele. Yeah. He was supposed to do wonders with people with depression or mental health issues.
Who says?
I don't know.
Like,
that's everybody said.
Yeah.
They treated him like a god, which I'm sure he loved. Oh my God. And he was playing God, yeah, right?
He was. He was like, I'm gonna erase your personality.
Yes. I'm gonna break you down to nothing. Yeah. You don't have an identity, no relationships.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Steele's mother, Jean, was put into chemically induced sleep once for 18 days and a second time for 29 days. She was subjected to rounds of electroshocks, injections of experimental drugs, and seemingly endless bouts of recorded messages. They say it was torture for human beings, human torture, said Steele, who was 4 years old when her mom was hospitalized. What they attempt to do is erase your emotions. They strip you of your soul. This is her words. After 3 months at the institution, her mother returned home. The treatments had taken a toll on her memory and left her riddled with nervousness and anxiety. She wasn't able to talk to me about life and regular stuff. She wasn't able to joke and laugh. At times, her mother would interrupt conversations to utter statements out of the blue, which Steele believes were the recorded messages that she'd been exposed to. She would blurt out something like, "We must do the right thing." Cameron, the psychiatrist behind the experiments, died in 1967 of a heart attack while mountain climbing. Okay. But recent decades have seen various attempts by former patients and their families to hold the Canadian government and the CIA accountable, which is fair.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, the Canadian government, which had provided grants from several agencies to fund Cameron's research, offered compensation payments of $100,000 to, which is $78,000 in U.S. dollars, to 77 former patients of the Institute who had been reduced to a childlike state in 1992.
Mm. So many years later.
Hundreds of others, including Steele's mother, were denied compensation at times because they were deemed to not have been damaged enough by the experiments.
You should not have been damaged at all.
Mm-hmm. Steele, who launched a legal challenge against the government in 2015, settled last year. Or this article was written in 2018, so 2017 was when they settled, receiving a $100,000 payment in Canadian dollars in exchange for signing a non-disclosure agreement.
Oh my God.
You know, see, everyone, what's up with everyone's perception of Canada, as if they aren't also just like colonizing assholes too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, art became Johnson's means of processing her family's painful history. A 2009 series uses a squirrel to represent her grandmother at times, after Orly Kouse once said that LSD injections made her feel like a squirrel trapped in a cage. Mm. A 2016 video installation shows Johnson wearing a mask from an old photo of her grandmother trying to prepare a meal. The doctor took her apart and put her back together, so it's an impossible task, said Johnson. Velma Orly Kouse's experience at the Montreal Institute left deep scars, but her fight for justice is a source of deep pride for her granddaughter. It's that mix that Johnson aimed to capture in a 2009 piece that painted over an image of her grandmother smiling as she balanced her two grandchildren in her lap, turning her grandmother's hands into vines and tendrils that wrap tightly around the children. Those vines, they're just a fact. They're not dark. It's not bad, she said. It seems strange to say this, but because of the horrific ordeal that my grandma went through and then going after the CIA, I grew up feeling like I'm from a family that stands up for things. And so this is a part of me now, and it's how I see the world. So that's like one story. Mm. These fuckers really just like ruined all these people's lives.
Yeah.
I mean, during a time too that like, I mean, mental health stigma exists now. I think, I mean, to be someone who was like, honestly, I'm feeling a little depressed, and to go forward and try to get mental health care, I feel like that's like a significant thing to do in the fucking 50s.
Yeah.
And then they went there.
And to have this happen.
Yeah. It gets worse because MKUltra and like experiments like this were a continuation of experiments that were done in Nazi camps and experiments that were done by the Imperial Japanese Army during World War II. And in the Nuremberg trials, Rudolf Hess was on trial for obviously committing like atrocious acts in Nazi camps as like a Nazi general. What was he? I don't even care.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever.
He was horrible, and he was buddy buddies with Hitler. He was like trying to claim amnesia, that he didn't remember anything. And you know who was on the team of psychiatrists who got to decide whether or not he had amnesia?
Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron?
Yes, absolutely. So he's sitting there in the Nuremberg trials, listening to all this shit.
And taking notes!
Taking fucking notes. Because he was doing the same shit. And the hypocrisy of the United States to be like, oh, we came in and we, like, shut down, like, concentration camps and we saved the fucking day. Yeah, so that's fucked. So this man was horrible and he did all that shit. Someone said, before I pass it on to you, someone was talking about in an article how it sounded like techniques outlined in A Brave New World, which I don't know if you've read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have.
Okay.
Aldous Huxley.
Aldous.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Who is actually friendos with who I'm just about to talk about.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What a connection. Yeah. Yeah, for folks who don't know, it's a 1932 dystopian novel. I was like, wow, I didn't realize it was 1932.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Me neither.
He was really talking about some shit a long time ago that feels relevant today. But anyways, it was a dystopian novel by Aldous Huxley about the dangers of rising technology and mass population control. You know, compliance and obedience. And I mean, he wasn't wrong. I feel that way about Ray Bradbury, too. I'm like, that bitch knows.
Yeah. It's cool to also read Aldous Huxley's last book ever that he wrote, which is Island.
Mm.
It's very interesting.
I feel like you've talked about
this before. Yeah, I have.
Say more.
It's like about a kind of utopian society that lives on this island. And this journalist goes there to kind of like cover what life is like there. It's a like very, very communal society where like, for example, children don't have parents. Like their parents are, they have like multiple sets of parents that take care of them. And when they go through, well, like puberty, they have like ceremony where they use plant medicine to like honor the transition through puberty, like all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But underlying the whole time in the book is that these like colonizers are trying to come in because there's like these resources on the island that they want. Mm-hmm. So it's a cool book. It was the last one that he ever wrote before he passed away. And he passed away in 1963. So, he's an interesting fellow.
Although, I mean, he's a white man, and that very much sounds like stuff Indigenous people have been saying forever.
For sure. Yeah, totally. The people in the island are Indigenous people.
So both and, because he's out here in, like, when? 1932 or whatever, using his, like, access to a platform.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Okay, yeah, apparently this book is supposed to be the utopian counterpart to Brave New World. Mm. Yeah, but you're right. He talks about this utopian society, which is very much based in already existing tons of Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be located like somewhere where Indonesia is.
Well, this is a perfect time to pass it on to you. Give people a little more idea about like what the fuck LSD... What's going on with LSD?
Yeah. I'm sure that some people listening, you know, everyone has heard of it one way or the other, but probably most people, unless you really dug into yourself, don't know, like, actual true facts about it, because there's just, like, so much socio-political, cultural baggage associated with it, part of which is, like, the MKUltra stuff and these experiments, for sure. LSD, lysergic acid lysergic acid diethylamide, commonly referred to LSD or acid, is actually the best known and most researched psychedelic drug of all time. It was discovered by Albert Hofmann in Sandoz Labs in Basel, Switzerland in 1938. He created it while trying to create a stimulant to treat respiratory and circulatory problems. And in 1938, when he synthesized it for the first time, he didn't know of its psychedelic effects. And when it was like tested on like animals, like rats and mice, it didn't seem to show that effect. So it was put to the side. And then in 1943, in April, he returned to it, synthesized another batch, and accidentally got some absorbed into his skin. And he says, quote, that he sank into a not unpleasant, intoxicated-like condition characterized by an extremely stimulated imagination. So he accidentally took some, and then he was like, what the heck? So then a couple days later, he was like, let me intentionally take some and see actually what happens. Mm-hmm. So he intentionally dosed himself with 250 micrograms at 4:20 p.m. on April 19th, 1943. He started to feel like it was going to be an intense experience. So he asked his assistant to help him get home. And because it was like wartime, cars were prohibited. So they had to bike home. And as he's biking home, he's like coming up. And so April 19th is now known as Bicycle Day, which is like the discovery of LSD Day. On his 100th birthday in 2006, he was at a symposium in Basel, Switzerland, and he shares about LSD. He also wrote this book called LSD, My Problem Child. Probably because all this bullshit happened like after, you know. He said, it gave me an inner joy, an open-mindedness, a gratefulness, open eyes, and an internal sensitivity for the miracles of creation. I think that in human evolution, it has never been as necessary to have the substance LSD. It is just a tool to turn us into what we are supposed to be. So you, people who were, you know, you're listening to what Shayna said, and you're like, how can this substance have this impact while also this impact, because those seem like really far ends of the spectrum, right? But if you know about LSD, it'll make sense why that happened. So getting into the science of it.
The science.
So it's derived from rye fungus and is a 5-HT or serotonin receptor activator. It deactivates the regulation of serotonin so that there's just like more active serotonin in the brain. There's 15 serotonin receptors in our brain, and the one that LSD prefers is the subtype involved with cognitive processes in the prefrontal cortex. LSD is like really wild because it's super active at exceptionally small doses. So like he ingested 250 micrograms the first time that he took it, and that's 2.5 times the regular dose. But it's all like you can still feel it at like 20 micrograms, and that's like very, very small compared to like any other kinds of, you know, drugs that you can think about. It's usually taken orally, sometimes as droplets, more commonly on blotter paper, and it's absorbed through the tongue and then swallowed. The common dose for it is 50 to 150 micrograms. And people say that the effects include deep introspection, can have feelings of euphoria. The effects are difficult to categorize because they impact people really, really differently based on a lot of different variables. A lot of people's experiences with it have tied LSD to be known for its ability to catalyze mystical or spiritual experiences that facilitate feelings of interconnection. So it increases sensory perception. For example, like if you're listening to a song, some people will say like, oh, wow, this is the first time I'm ever listening to the song because it like sounds entirely different. Mm-hmm. You can experience a sharpened sense of smell or taste or touch. People also say that they experience synesthesia, which is like when your senses kind of merge. So like when sounds have a smell, stuff like that. People experience vivid hallucinations, including the sense of time changing. So minutes can feel like hours, or the opposite way around. Real or imagined objects appear to be moving. So flowing patterns and shape. Both with eyes open or closed. You could have unusual thoughts and speech, personal insight, reflection, but individual reactions to these perceptual changes are very much based on set and setting, which I'll go into. So people can also have like negative reactions to this, including paranoia, anxiety, fear of death, and overwhelming feelings. So what is the set and setting? Setting talks about the external circumstances that a person is in. So like the environment that they're in, the people that they're with. And then set talks about like their mental state when they're going into this experience. Mm. So if we're thinking about Albert Hoffman's set and setting, he's like with his personal assistant who he trusts, and he is biking in nature and then is home, feeling comfortable, feeling safe. And so that's the environment that he's doing this in, where he has a pretty positive experience. Whereas like the people that you're talking about are already in a state of like mental distress, mm-hmm. and then are being psychologically tortured in all of these other ways. That's not horrible. Even counting LSD, they're in like a very clinical hospital setting. And so there's just like an environment of fear and anxiety and confusion that is just like enhanced. So if you just like think about it at the most basic level, like LSD is going to extremely enhance what your pre-existing condition is. Mm-hmm. So if your pre-existing condition is pretty chill, your set and setting, then you're probably going to have a pretty chill, good time. But if your pre-existing setting is like in these experiments that you didn't choose to be part of, and also like you've never experienced anything like this before, like, that's obviously going to trip the fuck out of you.
That sounds so fucking horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. A nightmare.
So, talking a little bit about, like, LSD's capacity for, like, harm. There's actually no lethal dose of LSD has ever been documented. So, no one has ever died specifically just from, like, taking too much acid or taking too much LSD. It's one of the least toxic drugs, and recent studies have shown lower rates of mental health disorders and suicide from people who have used LSD
by their choice. It's not addictive, doesn't lead to compulsive use due to being really long and intense and being mentally and physically challenging. The human body also builds a tolerance to it really fast, which means that like you have to take a lot more to have the same effect very quickly. So like if you took 100 micrograms and then took 100 micrograms the next day, you probably wouldn't feel it at all because your body just builds a tolerance to it. Some examples like of times where people took way too much LSD to just like kind of show how this isn't really a toxic drug. There was one report of how 8 people mistook LSD for cocaine and they ended up, they like snorted something that they thought was cocaine. It was actually pure LSD and it was 100 to 700 times the normal dose.
Oh,
so they
fuck.
Ingested like 1,000 to 7,000 micrograms of it. They all suffered comatose states, hyperthermia, vomiting, respiratory problems. But like within a couple of days, they had all recovered with hospital treatment and had no residual effects after that. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't have any pre-existing conditions.
They probably never did acid again.
Yes, probably. There's also this like paper that came out in 2019 where they covered these 3 different case studies of like LSD overdoses. One of them was this 15-year-old girl, also took like 1,000 micrograms of LSD. And she had previously had a diagnosis of bipolar 2 and had a history with like psychotic symptoms too, and had been hospitalized like twice before this. And this was like at a summer solstice party, and she wasn't the only one who ended up taking too much because the supplier pretty much just like did math wrong. And the things that were supposed to have one dose ended up actually having 10 times normal dose. She like had a lot of erratic behavior. They thought that she had a seizure, so they took her to the hospital. But then after like 12 hours, like her dad came and she was like, it's over. And he thought she was talking about the LSD overdose, but she actually meant that her bipolar disorder was cured. And in the months following that, her father and her like therapist observed that she like had seemed to be completely recovered from all of her mental health concerns after the accidental overdose. It's like she didn't have symptoms of bipolar or depression anymore for the subsequent 13 years until she gave birth to a child and then had postpartum.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. So like this was obviously not on, none of these are on purpose, but she like had this like positive effect. And then a similar thing happened to this 49-year-old woman who had Lyme disease and like was on morphine because of like chronic pain. And she did, it was kind of a similar situation where she thought it was cocaine. It was like 500 times the normal dose. She was like vomiting a ton for this next couple of days, but her roommate kind of just like sat with her through it. And then she reported that her pain was gone the next day. So she stopped using morphine, didn't have any withdrawal symptoms, even though like she had been taking it for like years. Her pain did return, but she restarted the morphine, but to a much smaller amount. And then she started microdosing, which is just funny. I'm like, this woman really like took 500 times the normal dose of LSD, but then was like, I'm gonna microdose to help with my chronic pain afterwards. And she did that for 3 years where she was taking a little bit of morphine and microdosing. And then she stopped all of her pain meds because her pain had been so significantly reduced.
Wow.
And she did not have withdrawal symptoms after stopping the morphine.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So this is just to say, like, this substance is just, like, people's experiences with it can be extremely variable. There's no toxicity level for it that has ever been discovered to this day, even though people have overdosed on it pretty significantly. This is not to say, obviously, that there haven't been many cases of adverse psychological reactions to LSD that have led to people, you know, trying to kill themselves or, you know, developing psychosis that lasts a lot longer. So there's this thing that's pretty rare, but it's called hallucinogen persisting perception disorder, or HPPD, and it's characterized by a continual presence of sensory disturbances, most often visual, continuing for months or years following psychedelic use. It's usually treated with antipsychotics or anti-seizure medication.
it's rare, but it's more likely to occur if psychedelics are taken outside of a safe and responsible situation, which MK Ultra and all of its experiments are some next level of unsafety.
Yeah.
You know, like the bare basics of like harm reduction, especially when it comes to psychedelics, is like set and setting is just like make sure that you're with safe people in an environment that you feel comfortable in, and that when you go into it, you're like in an okay enough mental state or have someone like there to support you and guide you through the process, you know, and you're taking like a normal amount of it. It's and like, you know, people who use psychedelics regularly will probably be using this like once or twice a year because of how like significant of an impact it has on you. Just keep that in mind as we like go into talking about the experiments later on. So rewind. Sandoz, the lab that synthesized LSD for the first time, started sending samples of it to psychiatrists, scientists, and mental health professionals around the world so that they could do more research on it. So this was in the early 40s, and for the next two decades, thousands of experiments with LSD led to, you know, people understanding how it affected consciousness in different ways. I will pass it back to you.
Okay, so LSD, wide variety of experiences, and obviously MK Ultra, really irresponsible and horrible use of it. So
yeah,
I'm going to go back to MK Ultra a bit. Akshay's going to dive in like later, so I'm going to scratch the surface to bring you to more context, because I think it's important for you to know the backdrop under which this was happening. So as we mentioned before, this project operated from the 1950s until the early 60s and was created and run by a chemist named Sidney Gottlieb, who is the man who brought LSD to the United States. In the early 1950s, he arranged for the CIA to purchase the world supply of LSD for $240,000, which I'm not even sure how that translates now. And as Akshay mentioned, they disseminated it out, but they disseminated it to clinics, hospitals, prisons, and other institutions to carry out quote-unquote research projects and find out what LSD was, what its effect was, how it could be used as a tool for mind control. This journalist, Stephen Kinzer, who wrote a book about this, said that it was the most sustained search in history for techniques of mind control. And this was happening during the Cold War, which was a heightened time of like deep paranoia and honestly like wild imperialist hunger for power and control. Like the US really just wants to take over the whole fucking world.
Yeah, yeah.
And they say this too, blatantly. Anyways.
Side note, I just want everyone to know that when I was in high school, I thought that it was called the Cold War because it was cold in Russia.
Why are you sharing that?
I just think it's funny. I've learned things since then, but I didn't know anything about it. So I was like, Cold War.
Cold War.
It's cold in Russia.
Okay. You know, to be fair, history is not taught well. And
exactly.
Why is like your education in Singapore so centered around the US to begin
with? Oh my God, yeah, it is. Well, I didn't learn anything about Asian history.
That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, the stuff that I learned about like South Asian and East Asian history has been from reading magical realism, historical fiction books, not in school.
Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Stephen Kinzer guy, I listened to a NPR interview with him, Fresh Air. You can look it up. And he said the CIA became paralyzed with the fear that communists had perfected some kind of drug or potion or technique. Potion. CIA is out here trying to be witches. Gosh,
yeah.
That would allow them to control human minds. This was actually a greatly exaggerated fear, but it played on something culturally that affected everyone that grew up during the mid-20th century. So he talks also about how there's lots of media shows, cartoons that depicted this kind of thing. So everyone was on high alert. And this is around the time the Korean War is ending. And the New York Times published a startling story that was saying that American prisoners of war were returning to the country and they may have been converted, quote unquote, by communist brainwashers, which is what I was noting earlier in our conversation. Yeah. Some GIs were confessing to war crimes, like carrying out germ warfare against the communists.
Yeah.
A charge the U.S. categorically denied. They did that shit. And germ warfare is just another way to say biological warfare.
Yeah.
And others were reportedly so brainwashed that they'd refused to return to the U.S. And also, the U.S. was weeks away from secretly sponsoring the overthrow of a democratically elected leader in Iran.
The hypocrisy.
It's wild out here. So, the CIA was also interested in being able to manipulate foreign leaders with these techniques and would later invent several schemes to drug Fidel Castro.
Jesus.
Yeah. This is also during the time of the Red Scare, which...
It's like everyone's scared of communism.
Yeah. It was just like a fear-mongering tactic that was pushed forward by Senator Joseph McCarthy to really just like surveil people. And, like, identify them as communists and punish and criminalize them and, like, oust people from their jobs. So they used the foundation. Like, it was true that the USSR had carried out espionage activities inside the U.S. with the aid of some U.S. citizens during World War II. And so they really used this and they ran with it to, like, fearmonger everyone in the United States. This really escalated things. On March 21st, 1947, President Harry Truman issued Executive Order 9835, which was also called the Loyalty Order, and that mandated all federal employees be analyzed to determine whether they were sufficiently loyal to the government.
Oh my gosh.
The way that we're so nationalistic and have the nerve to, like, shake fingers at dictatorships in other countries as if we're not like that is wild to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like you're talking about brainwashing when you still fuel shit tons of propaganda throughout the media,
mm-hmm.
like about a vast variety of things. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just thinking about this video that I watched the other day about how romantic relationships are built to oppress women and how all of these like mass media like things, rom-coms essentially, it's a tool of capitalism so that like you get kind of insularized in your family unit and disconnected from community, and that your only definition of love exists within romantic love, when across history there's been all these other definitions of it. So like they're talking about brainwashing when, to a certain extent, we're all brainwashed because we are socially conditioned, you know?
Yes.
So, like, what is your definition of brainwashing? Your definition of brainwashing is when people have beliefs that you don't agree with.
Yeah. They're like, we want to control minds, but it's not brainwashing.
Yeah.
Bye. They also, I don't know, this also reminds me of, I didn't take notes on this, but when we're looking at timeline, this is also not long after Japanese incarceration. So the same rhetoric around, like, you're not loyal to the U.S. government. For folks who don't know, after Pearl Harbor happened, the American government, under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt, decided that Japanese people in the United States were a threat to
national security.
Were like mandated to leave their homes and their jobs and like relinquish all of their like assets to be incarcerated on like racetracks and then later in horse stables. There was a time in there where they were trying to recruit Japanese people to go to war, and it was like this dichotomous thing of like, are you loyal to the United States? If you're loyal to the United States, then you have to prove it by going to war for us. And those of you who choose not to, we're going to send you to Manzanar. I think it was Manzanar, but I'll double check. Okay, I double checked, and I was wrong. Manzanar was the largest camp, but those who were considered quote-unquote disloyal were sent to Tule Lake. And I call them incarceration camps because I was reading online that, like, internment implies, like, a war enemy. Mm. You know, like, internment implies that the person, like, is, like, an enemy of the state.
Yeah.
When really these were just, like, everyday citizens. Like, here in Seattle, at some point in time, Japanese people were, like, the largest non-white population. And that number is, like, dwindled down greatly. They used to, like, have a lot of, like, some farmland.
Now they I mean, we briefly talk about one instance of that in our first episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of how a person lost their entire business because this white lady was like, oh, I'll keep it safe for you while you're gone. And then when they came back,
she was like, it's mine.
Yeah.
If there's anything we learn in this podcast, it's that white people can't be trusted. Come at me. Anyways. What was I trying to say?
You're talking about the Red Scare.
The Red Scare, Japanese okay.
This is a loyalty context. Thing. Yeah.
Social context. Okay, and then when incarceration was over, there was, like, all of this, like, all of these policies and shit that, like, Japanese people could not congregate together, and they would be punished for it, and they were so traumatized that there was stories of this, like, this man was saying, you know, I'd be walking and I'd see another Japanese man across the street and I would immediately just, like, walk the other direction so that they couldn't blame me for, like, congregating. Aww. And they couldn't lock me up again. And so it's just, like, really intentional the way the United States inserts black and white thinking and, like, forces people into a place of loyalty or disloyalty. And then all of a sudden you become an enemy of the state. And they also, like, ship Japanese people all across the country in different areas so that that community could not, you know, you can't create community. And if you can't create community, you can't unite and struggle. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so back to the Red Scare. Around the same time, the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, was, like, really quick to conflate any kind of protest with communist, quote-unquote communist subversion. And this included civil rights demonstrations led by Martin Luther King Jr. So Hoover was like, King is a communist, and he was covertly working to intimidate and discredit Martin Luther King. Which makes sense because we know the CIA did all this weird shit where they, like, surveilled him and tapped his phone and shit. Just fucking racist. And then at the same time, people don't talk about the Lavender Scare, conflating, like, gayness with communism too. They just wanted to persecute people who didn't fall within the confines of, you know, traditional American values.
Yeah.
In 1947, this is in Washington, D.C., U.S. Park Police initiated a quote-unquote sex perversion elimination program targeting gay men for arrest and intimidation. And then a year later, Congress passed an act that was, quote-unquote, for the treatment of sexual psychopaths in the nation's capital. Which is just so wild to me, because last I checked, colonizers are the most
perverse.
I mean, they're just, like, the rapists of the world.
Yeah, pedophiles.
I just, what? I can't. The way that they just project their own shit.
Yeah, just all their internalized homophobia.
Yeah. So this was the law that facilitated the arrest and punishment of gay people. And also they labeled them mentally ill, which I feel like connects to the Jack episode when we talk about why, like, the conversation about BDSM and, like, how we just need to be more intentional about how we're using the terms, like, sadism and shit, because it's a slippery slope into this
pathology.
This kind of pathology.
Yeah.
Because they, like, grouped everything in one category.
Yeah.
So they're like, this is a subversive threat.
It seems like any kind of sex outside of the purpose of reproduction seems to fall into this perversion category, does it not? You know, like, that's the definition that they're going for, and that's what they're trying to do right now as well with all these, like, oppressive reproductive laws. They're pretty much trying to tell you,
oh, any sex that you have outside of the purposes of reproduction is wrong.
Mm-hmm. This shit is so puritanical. Yeah. I'm like, what in the actual fuck are we doing?
They're trying to ban condoms in some places.
Like, bro, this is not about abortion.
No.
This is about controlling and criminalizing people's bodies.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to ban IUDs. Like, goddamn. I want people to just have pleasure.
I mean, so much of the work of oppression is...
Yeah.
Telling people that they're not entitled to their pleasure.
Yeah, yep, that's true.
Oppressive people get so angry when they just see a group of people having a good time that they decide is like not part of their in group.
Yeah, totally. It made me think about like times where I have just been out with friends for the purpose of chilling or having a good time and like have had like men insert themselves into the situation in a way which made us feel so uncomfortable, and I'm just like, yeah, people experiencing pleasure is not okay for those that want the powers that be, you know, pleasure, mm-hmm. freedom.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that in like the witches episode too, on how like in India and in other places, like women doing what they want to do mm-hmm. is seen as an affront, and so that they're like violently oppressed for just like existing.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and I don't know if this was included in the last episode, but I feel like I've talked about pleasure activism before. Mm-hmm. If folks haven't read it, it's really good. It's a collection of essays curated by Adrienne Marie Brown, and it's very good. It's about the politics of pleasure. So, this is the backdrop. In February 1950, McCarthy delivered a now famous speech in which he claimed to have a list of 205 known communists working at the State Department. I mean, I just imagine it included anybody who diverted away from the status quo,
mm-hmm.
particularly people of color and queer folks. So, fuck that.
Yeah.
But, that's what was going on during this time of MK Ultra. I'm going to pass it back to Akshi to tell you about like what the fuck MK Ultra was all about.
Yeah. As we were starting to do research on this topic, it's just like there's so much information about it, like so much. And that only also scratches the surface because most of the documents about MK Ultra, like 90% of the documents of it, were destroyed so that no one would ever find it. This is literally just like the surface of it. And because there's so much information and it requires a lot of digging deeper into things that we wanted to dig deeper into, I'm going to give you now like kind of a general overview of like the experiments that were being done, but I'm not going to dig into them because we're going to save that for the next episode. So keep that in mind. So this is just a lot of context, which is very important when going into the story mm-hmm. from our perspectives. So MKUltra started in April 1953. It had over 149 what they called sub-projects that are known about, and it occurred across 80 different institutions, including universities, prisons, hospitals, including studies funded at Columbia University, Stanford, and other colleges. Part of MKUltra was administering LSD to patients in mental institutions, incarcerated folks, those with substance use disorders. It was also administered to CIA employees, military personnel, doctors, government agents, and members of the general public. That was one part of MKUltra, a big part of it, but it also included research on other drugs, and many sub-projects focused on the use of like one drug alone or in combination with other techniques to manipulate people. So like Shana said earlier, the main purpose of this was to like figure out how to like control people, whether mm-hmm. there's a way for mind control. So whether that be with drugs or like other kinds of techniques.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So other drugs that were used in these experiments were barbiturates, amphetamines, heroin, morphine, temazepam, mescaline, psilocybin, which is mushrooms, scopolamine, alcohol, and sodium pentothal. So those are some. Subproject 5 of MK Ultra was at the University of Minnesota, and they were testing using hypnosis to induce anxiety and also how to teach people how to thwart lie detectors and induce trances. One very interesting subproject, which Kinzer goes into in his book, is subproject 4, where they used a celebrity stage magician, John Mulholland, to teach CIA agents techniques of misdirection and sleight of hand to better distract targets while they were drugging them. The manual that Mulholland produced for the CIA actually resurfaced in 2007, and it's the only full-length MKUltra document known to have survived fully intact. Most of these experiments occurred where the drugs were administered without the subject's knowledge or consent, which is a direct violation of the Nuremberg Code, which the U.S. agreed to follow right after World War II.
Oh, I forgot to talk about Operation Paperclip.
Oh.
Should I do that now?
Yeah.
Sidebar, there was this Operation Paperclip. Don't know why it was called that, but it was a secret U.S. intelligence program. More than 1,600 Nazi German scientists, engineers, and technicians were taken from Nazi Germany to the U.S. for government employment after World War II ended between 1945 and 1959. Okay. Conducted by the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency. It was mostly carried out by special agents of the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Corps. But many of these personnel were former members and some were former leaders of the Nazi Party. So, like, we're really just out here consulting with Nazis, employing Nazis.
Yeah.
Taking notes from Nazis while simultaneously being like Nuremberg trials and then totally back, like
being Nuremberg code, let's sign this. Oh, but we're not going to follow it.
No.
Because it doesn't matter to us. And Operation Paperclip was also like, it's like part of the Cold War stuff where they were like, oh, let's try to figure out how to fight the communists with the help of the Nazis.
With the help of the Nazis.
That's kind of a really overarching general overview. What we'll go into next time is digging kind of deeper into the experiments, but also we'll talk about how MKUltra pretty much introduced psychedelic counterculture in the 60s, and we'll talk a little bit about that and how that led to the criminalization of LSD and the Controlled Substances Act generally. I will end with one quote that is from Mike J's review of Stephen Kisner's book, and then I will pass it to Shayna to give us a little glimpse into the wonderful Sydney, who was the lead conspirator, I guess. Mike says, "This was not the CIA as the American public was encouraged to imagine it, a dapper Ivy League fraternity coolly dedicated to safeguarding the nation. The picture that emerged was of a game without rules, played recklessly and with impunity by, as Stephen Kinzer characterizes it, a cast of obsessed chemists, cold-hearted spymasters, grim torturers, hypnotists, electroshockers, and Nazi doctors."
Wow. Yeah. I also want to mention, we can go into this further next time, that there were secret detention camps in other countries, Japan, Germany, and the Philippines, where Sidney Gottlieb wanted to, like, do experiments there because he just didn't have to deal with the repercussions of future legal problems in the United States, which he really didn't experience them here at all. But if you can imagine what he got away with here.
Yeah, imagine what they kind of did elsewhere. Like, it just blows my mind that this is, like, barely anything about what they did, and it's so fucked up on its own, of, like, what did they destroy? What was all the documentation that they destroyed?
Right, because this is, like, overwhelming information.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So they did that, and it kind of like, it's kind of like giving me Guantanamo vibes. Mm. And then I was looking into Guantanamo, and they do use tactics that are really mirror the tactics that were used in MKUltra projects. And so Japan, Germany, and the Philippines, the U.S. had military control of all those places. So they were like hot spots to go and try to, you know, they just did whatever the fuck they wanted. And also connects back to how many times do we talk about how fucking U.S. military soldiers go to Japan and are sexually violent.
Yeah.
Anyways, there's a confluence of two interests. Sidney Gottlieb is like, I want to discover mind control. But also the CIA was capturing quote-unquote enemy agents and quote-unquote expendable people. Whatever the fuck that means.
Well, you know what that means is that they targeted a lot of vulnerable groups in doing these experiments, which dig deeper into next time. But a CIA official truly admitted that they targeted people who, quote, could not fight back or would not complain afterward or didn't have the ability to complain and be believed afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
So
a lot of these people, I mean, all of these people that they captured were incarcerated and then they tortured them. This included LSD and other tactics like electroshock, therapy again, sensory deprivation, bombarding with questions to the point of exhaustion and overwhelm to in an attempt to destroy the human ego, very much like What's-His-Face at the psychiatric hospital wanted to do. Mm-hmm. They also mirrored some of the sedating people into the coma state and then forced stimulants. So they would put people into coma state and then they would be like, oh, you're too sleepy, and then, like, pump them up with stimulants, and then they're wired, and then they would shock them!
Like, it's really not surprising, and it's extremely sad that Miss Orlikov, like, her nervous system was so fried that even the smallest stuff was, like, putting her into a state of panic.
Yes,
because they really brought her inner child, which was probably fine, to the surface, and then traumatized the fuck out of her nervous system.
Yes.
So much that she was just, like, in a raw state for the rest of her life.
Yes.
She, like, was pretty much a raw nerve.
Yeah.
That's what he did to her.
I was listening to interviews with all these people's kids and grandkids. Kids were like, you know, it's a special kind of grief to be present with your parent and see that they're no longer there. Mm-hmm. And you can't get them back.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
So Sidney Gottlieb was very into all of that. And it got us thinking, like, what the fuck happened to Sidney? Why is he like this? I couldn't find any information about his childhood at all. But I did find that he was born to Hungarian. Wow, he's just mixed up Hungarian Jewish. Born to Hungarian Jewish immigrant parents, Fanny and Louis Gottlieb, in the Bronx on August 3rd, 1918.
Fucking Leo.
A fucking Leo.
It's Leo, man.
Like Jack.
Yeah. Jack. Elizabeth Bathory is also Leo.
Wow, Elizabeth. She really did like the spotlight.
Yeah. Anyways, back to Sidney.
Yeah. It's interesting because Wikipedia says he was born with a club foot.
Oh.
Which got him rejected from the military service in World War II, but it did not prevent his pursuit of folk dancing, a lifelong passion. Okay. It just kind of reminds me of Hitler. Hitler had a bunch of weird things, like he was a vegetarian, and he loved the circus, and he was rejected from art school, and that's really what, like, set him on his journey to being a fucking asshole. He was like, I'm rejected. They always do that.
Rejection sensitivity dysphoria to some next level.
In conjunction with, like, white supremacy and patriarchal violence.
Yeah.
Great.
My rejection sensitive dysphoria is just that I cry at the most silly things.
Oh.
You know, it's not in conjunction with white supremacy and patriarchal violence.
Yeah, it just goes to show that
it's in conjunction with people pleasing Sidney.
Anyway, Sidney. So he's out here, he's folk dancing.
How do you go from folk dancing to mind control?
I don't know.
And wanting to buy all of the LSD in the entire world.
You know, it looks like he tried to get into the military and he was like, I need to be a man. Right?
Sure.
And he's like, but I love to folk dance, but I'm not feeling like, you know, do think like this grasping for control is like you not being to attain the level of manness that society tells you you need to be.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Gender as trauma.
So he graduated from high school in 1936. He enrolled in a free city college in NYC. He like transferred to the University of Wisconsin, and then he went to Arkansas Tech University, where he studied botany, organic chemistry, and principles of dairying. His success at Arkansas Tech won him admission to the University of Wisconsin, where he was mentored by Ira Baldwin, the assistant dean of the College of Agriculture. So his like area of focus is like very agriculture-based, which is interesting. He was denied the chance at military service again, and then so he sought out a different way to serve, to quote-unquote serve. And so this is when he went to go look to work in government and in Washington, D.C. This is kind of interesting. It's interesting to me because we, like, think of CIA people to be, like, these, like you were saying, like, Ivy League fraternity boys. And it sounds like he really came from,
that's not,
you know, like, immigrant working class, community college, liked agriculture.
Yeah.
And then him and his family lived in a remote cabin in Virginia for a long time that had no electricity, no running water. And that's where he was when he began to work at the CIA.
Interesting.
So his first government position was in the Department of Agriculture, where he researched the chemical structure of organic soils. He was transferred to the Food and Drug Administration. He developed tests to measure the presence of drugs in the human body. And then he got bored, and he wanted to be challenged. So in 1948, he found a job at the National Research Council. This is where he described being, quote-unquote, exposed to some interesting work concerning ergot alkaloids as vasoconstrictors and hallucinogens.
Yeah.
He soon relocated to the University of Maryland as a research associate, and he began studying metabolisms of fungi. And then on the 13th of July, 1951, this is when he starts working at the CIA.
And MKUltra started 1953.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't there very long. He just decided. Gottlieb loved LSD. He took it more than 200 times. The Wikipedia says he tended towards Buddhism, which I find interesting.
Wow, the cognitive dissonance.
Like, what kind of energy are you putting out in the world, sir?
Yeah. Jesus.
So he's, like, super... And then he goes into, like, I want to find a truth serum. I want to find an amnesiac. I want to control agents to engage in sabotage or assassination. I'm just like, wow, the escalation here.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of information about how or why he escalated.
Yeah.
There's just,
how,
like,
how did this happen?
Yeah. It just went from, like, I'm living off the grid. I like to folk dance.
Yeah.
I'm Buddhist. I love LSD. Yeah. I mean, what?
Yeah.
And then he's like, now I want to control the world and do this really unethical shit and ruin people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, so, like, back to these other detention camps that he really, like, was doing some wild ass shit. He, like, really had license to, like, kill these people. There was no oversight. Supervisors didn't want to know anything that he was doing so he could avoid legal entanglements that he might run into, like we were talking about before. And the idea of global world power outweighed the harm that was done in these experiments to him. And he did this for 10 years without any intervention at all.
What I'll leave you with at the end is, an operation that occurred under MKUltra in San Francisco, in Marin County, and in New York City. which had very little oversight. It was called Operation Midnight Climax.
Oh, God.
There's a quote that I read that said, CIA agents involved admitted that a freewheeling, party-like atmosphere prevailed. So this was an operation in which government employed sex workers, lured unsuspecting men to safe houses where they conducted drug experiments, and they were watched through one-way mirrors and also recorded. They were dosed with LSD. The CIA agents that were watching would often drink cocktails, and like it was just like entertainment for them. So
live porn.
Yeah, exactly. So an agent named George White, who will come up some more next time, talked, his diary was one of the things that was found that a lot of the MKUltra stuff came out with, but there was a quote from it that said, "Of course I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic, but I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, deceive, rape, and pillage with the sanction and the blessing of the All Highest?"
Bye! My God.
So that is very much the energy of MKUltra.
Oh my God.
That's a little teaser for you.
It's a little teaser!
You're probably going to have to wait a little while for the next episode, probably a couple weeks. We'll try to get to it. But we really were like, there's way too much information to cover.
You got the context.
Yeah.
And then next time we're going to dig deeper into the individual experiments.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're going to learn more.
Same vibe as Stranger Things, right?
Oh, it is.
Coming out the same time as Stranger Things.
Okay. Well, on a good note, I guess, speaking of Stranger Things, the scene in the last season where, what's his name? The kid without the teeth.
Dustin.
Where Dustin and his little girlfriend are singing Neverending Story.
Yeah.
It is so cute.
It is.
Sometimes when I'm having a bummer day, I'll just go and watch that scene on YouTube.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
It is so cute. I love it.
Yeah, Dustin's great. I started watching the new season. It's pretty scary, but it's also good.
Do you have a favorite character?
I think Steve is honestly my favorite character.
Steve
and Robin. Yeah, and I like their... Steve, Robin, and Dustin.
Steve.
They are my favorites.
That surprises me.
Yeah.
Steve came around.
Yeah. He's like dad energy.
He is dad energy. He really was a shithead for
a while. He was. And then they really... but I really like Robin, too. You know, she's like the queer character. But also, I relate to her. She's very clumsy.
Oh.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Funnier than I am. I'm funny on accident. Anyways, so we end on a little not so horrific note.
Yeah. See you next time.
Bye. Thanks for listening and for supporting us. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Unpacking the Eerie, on Twitter at Unpack the Eerie, and on our website at www.unpackingtheeerie.com.
Yes, and special thanks to all of you who subscribe to our Patreon. As we've mentioned before, we do all the research for this, we edit, and we don't have any sponsorships or ads. So Patreon support is super helpful in just keeping this project sustainable, keeping the Buzzsprout subscription going, paying for the website, all the stuff. So thank you so much.
Sari, Liz, Clifton,
Jill, Victoria, and Lindsay,
Lauren, Vivian, Valerie,
Micheline, Montana, Katrina,
Raina, Allie, Jake,
Drithi, Daphne, and Katie,
Vern, Meredith H, and Vince,
to April, Aaron, and Ellen,
and to Brittany, Alyssa, and Meredith R.
Yay, thank you so much.
Thank you.